All right. I was invited to give a talk on the effects of elevated CO2 on growth and control of invasive species, and we've not done anything with aquatics, so I'm going to change gears a little bit and talk about some land plants. And first, I'd like to recognize my co-authors, Dr. Steve Chris Marble. He goes by both, but mostly Chris. He was a PhD student at Auburn University and the hardest working student I've ever had the pleasure and privilege of working with. And we've had a great time with him, and he finally graduated and got a good job. So, and then Steve Pryor is the project leader of the Global Change Program at Auburn, USDA ARS Global Change Program, and Alan Torbert is a research leader at the lab. So I'm going to basically give a very brief summary of the effects of CO2 on plants, just to kind of get everybody up to speed, and a brief history of some of the work on elevated CO2 in weeds, and then I'll delve into some of the work that we've done at our lab because I'm more familiar with that. Then we'll look at growth of invasive weeds under elevated CO2, and then we'll look at some of the control work, which is pretty new. The CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is increasing and has been since about the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. This is Keeling's graph from the Mauna Loa data, shows a sawtooth pattern, but a pretty constant increase of about 1.4 ppm per year. There's no real slowdown in this. It's been pretty steady. It's due mostly to fossil fuel burning and land use change. That is going from forests to other lands because forests tend to absorb a lot of CO2. The current daytime CO2 in Auburn, Alabama is sitting around between 390 and 400. When we started our research in 1993, it was sitting around 370, so it is increasing. The sawtooth pattern is from the northern hemisphere, and it has to do with when the trees are leafed out, the concentration drops a little bit. When the trees defoliate, it goes back up. The effects of elevated CO2 on plants. Most plants, given adequate water and nutrition, will respond positively to elevated CO2. They increase photosynthesis, they decrease stomatal conductance, and they increase water and nutrient use efficiencies. You tend to get a decrease in the nitrogen or other nutrient concentrations per unit mass because you have more mass. So it's a dilution effect. Most plants, but not all, will increase carbon allocation below ground because the law of the most limiting factor applies here. If they're getting enough CO2, they're going to divert carbon to the organs that are required for finding the most limiting resource, which will be the roots, looking for water and nutrients. And there's a lot of other morphological, physiological, and biochemical changes that have been noted in plants. And the CO2 research has been going on since about the 1970s. There's some really early work from about 1917 in Vermont. But the real concentration started in about the late 70s and has kind of been increasing almost exponentially since then. So we know a lot more now than we did in 1980. The rationale for looking at weeds, well, weeds cost growers a great deal of money, and this estimate may be a bit low for today's because this is data that I found about 2009 when we started our work on invasives. How they react is still unknown for a lot of species, particularly some of the newer species. And like I said, very few people have worked with elevated CO2 in aquatic plants, so that's a wide open field. We know that it in weeds as well as crop plants, it increases photosynthesis, resource use efficiency, carbon allocation below ground, and it may impact the competitiveness with crop plants. Bright said in his 1998 book, Bioinvasions in a Borderless World, that fast-growing, highly invasive plants may be able to profit directly from the CO2 in the atmosphere, and any slower-growing native plants are likely to be outcompeted and lose out. Some of the very early work was done by Patterson and his colleagues at North Carolina State University, mostly working in the phytotron and growth chambers. And they found that both C3 and C4 plants tend to respond positively to elevated CO2. And weeds tend to outcompete crop plants. They tend to grow a little bit more or sometimes a lot more. They looked at some crop-weed interactions and found that with the ones they looked at, that the C3 plants are likely to have little impact from C4 invasive or C4 weeds because the C4s tend to respond to a lesser degree because they have a CO2 concentrating mechanism, so the elevated CO2 does not directly impact them. They do increase water use efficiency, though, because they do close their stomates, and so there is some benefit. C3 plants tend to respond in the 30 to 40% range, which is pretty large. C4 plants in about the 10 to 15% range. And so Patterson's work showed that the C3 plants are likely to be able to outcompete the C4 weeds. And then there's a lot of other researchers. I'm not trying to ignore everybody else, but Patterson really was kind of like the driving force in the early work. So, and there's a lot of other aspects that have been looked at as far as climate change with temperature and precipitation, but don't really have time to go into all that. Lou Ziska with ARS in Beltsville, Maryland, has continued the work, and he continues it up till today. He's showing sometimes even greater growth. He looked at six weeds, not necessarily invasives, and found that they all responded much greater than any other plants that he's looked at before. He also found that looking at the concentration of CO2 at about 1900, he's actually scrubbed CO2 out of the atmosphere down to about 280 parts per million, and has found that the increase in invasives or an increase in weed growth from that time till today, a lot of that is likely due to the concentration of CO2 increasing over that period of time. He also looked at pollen production in ragweed and found that there's, for people who have allergies, particularly to ragweed, that the problems are likely to get a lot worse as CO2 continues because the pollen production was drastically increased. The Soil Dynamics Lab in Auburn, which is where I work, this was originally a tillage lab. We have, if you look in the bottom picture, you see these rails. These rails were set up over 9 different soil types that are common to the southeastern U.S. And it was mostly done to look at tillage implements and tire traction and things like that. The lab was set up and began construction in 1932, so we've been there a long time. It was actually opened in 1936. We've been there quite some time, and we're on the campus of Auburn University. We've done our work in open top chambers instead of out in growth chambers or in face sites. If anyone is familiar with the CO2 work, face is free air CO2 enrichment. It became a big deal in like the late 90s, early 2000s, where people wanted to get away from any possible micrometeorological impacts of your systems that you're studying with. The problem is it's extremely expensive. They have 30-meter rings. They elevate the CO2 to about 585. That was about the top where they could still gain control. And they were spending, at the Duke FACS site, they were spending $60,000 a day in CO2. So that has closed down. I think all the FACS sites in the U.S., I believe, are now closed. There may still be one in Australia working. I'm not sure about the Rhinelander site. It could still be up, but I don't think so. Anyway, the CO2, the open-top chambers are much more efficient economically. And we have 3 sets of these at our facility. We have 3 different bins. The one that we do the invasive work on is a gravel bin. The soil became, the drainage bed on the soil got destroyed, and so this constantly remained flooded, and so we've put a membrane, geomembrane liner on it, and then gravel, and then we use the open tops, which are 10 foot in diameter, so we can fit a lot of plants in there when they're in containers. We've looked at Johnson grass, which is, now, a lot of people are going to look at these plants and go, well, these are not invasive plants. Well, they actually are. They've just been here a long, long time. Johnson grass was introduced in the, 1860s, 1870s. It was brought in primarily as a forage, and turned out to be very poor quality forage, but it really liked the southeastern United States. Yellow and purple nutsedge, one's from Eurasia, one's from the Mediterranean. They've been here a long time as well, but and how they were introduced, nobody's really certain. Sickle pod, nobody's really knows when it came in. It's thought to have come in from the tropical Americas, South Central America. Tropical spiderwort is a newer introduction, maybe 20, 25 years, from, I believe it's from Africa, and Asia and Africa, that area. Chinese privet, of course, from Asia, from China. And these are some of the ones that we've looked at. Just real quick pictures from Bugwood at University of Georgia, for the most part. Johnson grass, again, it's been here a long, long time. The nutsedge, sickle pod. I'm sure most people who've ever worked out in the field have seen sickle pod. It's really common. It's everywhere. The tropical spider wart. It's a big problem in peanuts in South Alabama and Georgia, and then the Chinese privet, which is everywhere. And it was introduced as a hedge and as an ornamental. And it's a real problem. It spreads very prolifically. We found the basically, they all showed a positive response to elevated CO2. The response varied quite a bit. The dry weight increased, water use efficiency for the ones we looked at increased, photosynthesis increased in all but yellow nutsedge, and why that happened, we're not certain. But the tropical spiderwort and the privet responded to the largest part, and then the nutsedge is a little bit less, and the Johnson grass, which is the C4, a little bit less, but they all responded positively to elevated CO2. We also looked at Kogon grass. Kogon grass was introduced from the Philippines and Southeast Asia. It was brought in two forms mostly. It was brought in as packing material in shipping containers. And it was really, it's loose, it's very fluffy. And so it was made a great packing material. It was also brought in as a potential forage. Unfortunately, the leaves contain a large amount of silica, and so cows can't eat it. It rips their tongues up. It's a real problem in forestry. Anywhere there's disturbance, it's a very large problem. You can't burn it. It likes to be burnt. And there was I worked for an international paper company for a while, and they had a small, about 12-acre plantation that got infested. And the forester decided in winter he was going to burn it. Well, he killed all the pines, and the Johnson grass came back the next year even better than it was before. There are some herbicides that can control it now, and so they're using those. We looked at six different ecotypes. The ecotypes are thought to have come in from different ports. We looked at, there's one in Florida, Louisiana, Mobile, North Alabama. There's a hybrid, and I've tried to get up with the fellow that gave us these and figure out what the hybrid is. It's a hybrid of two of the previous four, but I'm not sure which, because he actually is working for industry and doesn't want to talk to us. So, and then there was an ornamental called Red Baron, which has red tips on it. And it's still, as far as I know, it's still available for sale. It was at this time, because that's where we got it. We looked at height, carbon content, photosynthesis, dry weight, nutrient use efficiency, and water use efficiency. They all increased. The tissue in concentration, typical of elevated CO2 response, decreased because of a dilution effect. The Mobile and Red Baron did not respond to elevated CO2 at all, which is kind of good because the Red Baron is pretty safe to continue selling, seems like, as an ornamental variety. So what we found is that most of the ecotypes are going to respond and be more problematic as CO2 continues to increase, but not all of them. And lucky for the hort industry, not the Red Baron. We also looked at two common ornamentals, and these are also invasive species. Rica comes from Madagascar. Lantana comes from around Central America, the Tropic Americas. We weren't trying to negatively impact the hort industry. We were just really curious as to what would happen. These are both considered invasives in certain areas. Vinca is a real problem in Hawaii. Lantana is a real problem in the farming areas of India, but neither are considered a problem in the southeastern U.S. They're both widely planted. I have them in my yard. Lantana roots increased quite a bit. Vinca did not. Vinca's got a very fibrous root system. Lantana's got a very woody root system. And that's what we assess the response to elevated CO2S. So vinca is not likely to become a problem, but lantana could. It's spread by birds, particularly in India, and it's a very big problem there and could become a bigger problem. So control. And this is where it's very new research. It's been going on since only about 2009. Well, people are finding that control of invasives may be altered under a high CO2 environment. You have a larger plant. It may take more herbicide to gain the same level of control. There's other factors that can influence that, like the decreased stomatal conductance. You may have less uptake of the herbicide, and it's likely to vary. Work done by Ziska, again, and then a few others, has shown that there's an increase in herbicide tolerance of some plants, but not all, and it varies by which plant, which herbicide, and where you're at sometimes. Not all plants are showing increased tolerance. We found, looking at nutsedge, and this was some of Chris's work, right before he left Auburn, we found that on the purple and yellow nutsedge, there was no effect. We looked at a half rate, the recommended rate, and then one and a half rates in the, of two different herbicides, and their control was the same with all of them. So we were able to get effective control in ambient and elevated CO2. And we're going to continue some of this work. So to summarize, weed growth is generally increased by elevated CO2, and sometimes in weeds it's much greater than it is in crop plants. High CO2 can increase herbicide tolerance in some weeds. And then we're also starting to look at the weed-resistant, herbicide-tolerant or resistant populations. We're looking at pigweed and horsetail. We found herbicide-resistant populations. We're starting to look at how these may grow differently under elevated CO2, and then we're going to look at the control of those. And so with that, I'll wait for questions till the end. But thank you very much.